This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm Marty Lasden, and on this edition, we consider the future of the Republican Party. My guest is Donald Critchlow. He's a professor of history at Arizona State University, and he's director of the University Center for Political Thought and Leadership. His latest book is called, conveniently enough, Future Right, Forging a New Republican Majority. Professor Critchlow, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Let's put Donald Trump aside for a moment, if that's possible, and begin with what I guess is something of a threshold question. And that is, are there still enough white men and women living in this country for a traditional Republican running in a traditionally Republican sort of way to ever again win a presidential election?
Yes, 70% of the electorate's white. It's an aging population that is going to be here for quite a while. We have a growing Hispanic and minority population. We're here in Arizona, 40% of the electorate is Hispanic. The problem that the Republicans face in the short term, as well as the long term, is the problem with young whites and Hispanic voters. On the other hand, the Democrats face a short-term problem, and that is white voters. They've lost the white vote, other than the younger white vote, but younger voters don't vote very much. So that's the issue, both in the short term and the long term, facing both parties.
Well, let's go back to the 2012 election. Mm-hmm. There's a conventional wisdom here that if the Republican nominee for president in 2016 wins the same 59% of the white vote that Mitt Romney won in 2012, he or she will have to win 30% of the non-white vote to win a majority, which doesn't seem very likely since Mitt Romney won only 17% of that non-white vote. That's more or less been the conventional wisdom. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I think there's always something to be said for conventional wisdom. There is an argument made by political demographers, Sean Trend, who have argued that there were 4 million or more white voters that didn't cast their vote. In other words, there wasn't that kind of blue-collar vote. The votes weren't lost so much in the South, which is surprising for Romney. He's a Mormon. People thought he wasn't going to play very well down in the evangelical South. Actually, he didn't tap into Midwestern Rust Belt voters. So part of, I know we wanted to leave Trump out. He's the
we're going to get to him.
But part of the strategy of Trump is tapping into that. Those lost white voters.
The exit poll data says that in 2012, 23% of voters were white over the age of 45 and did not have a college education. Mm-hmm. But then there's census data that suggests that figure is closer to 30%,
right,
which translates into another 10 million votes.
Right.
So that's not small potatoes, is it?
That's right. That's the counter argument to the conventional wisdom that that the Republicans can expand their white vote. But the demographics are changing in important ways as well, and that is intermarriage. 65% of Asian Americans are marrying whites. 45% of Hispanics are marrying whites. The children of these couples identify themselves as white. Even about 20% of African Americans are marrying whites. We're creating a new race of Americans. So one wonders, projecting 20 years out in the future, as we become very kind of a new race of Americans, how identity politics is going to play in terms of playing the race card.
And that bodes well for the Republican Party.
It, combined with some other things, as minorities become better educated and enter the middle class, which Hispanics are doing, and they become taxpayers, yeah, they're going to be more open to a Republican message of around government, around taxes, and so forth. The Republican Party is basically a middle class party. The Democrats say they're working for the middle class, but basically their base is largely an ethnic base. And so as it begins to change, I think there's great potential. Today, if I may, Marty, there are more Hispanic women going to college in proportion than white males graduating from high school. As these women go out and gain educational attainment and enter the middle class, there's opportunities for the Republicans to tap into that vote, not around identity politics, not around them being Hispanic, but around them being middle class.
You know, what about, you know, the fact that less educated tends to correlate with voting Republican? You're arguing that more education will make these people more open to Republican arguments, but you know, the fact that less educated tend to vote more Republican, more educated tend to vote Democrat, doesn't that contradict what you're saying?
I think it's a factor, no doubt. We have higher educated people are tending to vote Democratic. So there's a lot of explanations for that, however.
What's yours?
I think it needs to be broken down demographically.
So you're talking about young people, and so let's talk about millennials. This is a group of young men and women who were born between 1980 and 2000. You say in your book that Republicans have a strong case to make to these young voters on economic issues. Mm-hmm. And I think you actually make a pretty good argument there. When we're talking about same-sex marriage or the environment or guns or education, is it your sense that a solid majority of millennials are at all on the same page with Republicans on any of those issues?
Well, thank you. In future right, I make an argument that the young vote can be won. Let's keep in mind one important thing. Young people don't vote. But again, the issues are not what you're talking about, like gun control and same-sex marriage and so forth. It's economic issues.
Well, have you ever heard of a book called The Selfie Vote?
Yes.
This is a book by a Republican pollster named Kristen Soltis Anderson.
Right.
And she says that in focus group after focus group, she finds that the standard Republican Party line against same-sex marriage is for young people a deal breaker, regardless of what their sexual orientation is. You don't believe that?
The argument that's been made by young Republicans, and they've been pushing this in the Republican National Committee, is that exactly around those issues, the social issues, they're losing young voters. Yeah. And it does present a problem for Republicans in this way. In primaries, evangelical voters are extremely important. So in a primary, a Republican candidate has to go out and talk about social issues. What happened in the last midterm is that Republicans learned how to speak about those issues, and they were successful. it was close to a wave election. So as I argue and give examples in Future Right of how they mastered that issue, I mean, in terms, language means a lot. Yeah. So we're not talking about changing principles. We're talking about how to present issues.
We're talking about packaging.
We're talking about not going for candidates, not going out and being angry and looking angry and look like they're attacking groups.
I think that's a good segue to talk about Donald Trump. I think we've exercised admirable restraint up until this point, but he is the elephant in the room. And in 2016, he has won the Republican nomination by defeating, if not utterly humiliating, 16 other Republicans who ran for president this year. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie among them. And of course, there has been no shortage of attempts to explain how in the world that happened. How in the world do you think it happened?
He's tapped into this anxiety around jobs and safety. People in America, which is a relatively new country, and a very unusual country that's so diverse, ethnically, religiously, culturally, people are concerned with order. And that's what they're most concerned with. They're not concerned with, most people are not concerned with parsing the Constitution. They're not concerned with fine lines of differences on policy. What they're concerned with is safety for their families and advancement for them, economic, financial advancement for themselves and their children.
True or false? True or false? The nomination of Donald J. Trump for President of the United States would not have been possible without the help of Republicans in Congress who turned Congress into such a dysfunctional mess. They made it much easier to believe that only someone as intemperate as Donald Trump could get anything done.
I would say it's partly true and partly false.
Okay, give me what's the true part and what's the false part?
Well, first of all, there's, I think, a perception among Republicans that it was just that it was just problems of a Republican Congress not doing their job. There was some discontent, and it was vocal. I don't think that's...
The popularity ratings of Congress are, like, in the toilet, right?
Yeah, but they were when the Democrats were in charge, too. I mean, this is a
low?
Real problem.
This low?
Well, it's kind of a self-feeding mechanism.
Let me read to you a quote from David Frum, who was a speechwriter for George W.
I know
Bush.
David.
Good, good. And for many years, he was a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He writes, "If the Republican leadership had been more responsive to the needs of its voters and less swayed by the demands of its donors, the party might have changed from within. Now it's the target of a hostile takeover that will stamp the Trump brand as indelibly upon the Republican Party as it was once stamped on the cityscape of Atlantic City. That branding ended in ruin for Atlantic City, and the GOP is unlikely to fare better." You think he's wrong?
Right now, people get caught up in kind of emotion. That's what happens in a democracy. You have pundits like David Frum having to make predictions, and so they're warning of disaster.
At the very least, he's expressing a worry that a lot of people share, Republicans share.
Right.
You know, before we go any further, mm-hmm. I want to make a confession.
Uh-oh.
And that is that while...
I'm not a priest.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I feel I need to do this. You know, and that is that, you know, while I am a left-of-center person, I do think that if the government were run entirely by people like me, it would be a complete disaster. and the reason I say that is because I think it is important that there are at least a few adults in the room. People who are willing to say things like, before we redistribute wealth, we got to think about creating wealth. And before we spend boatloads of money fighting poverty, we ought to make sure we know what we're doing. But here's the thing, when I look at the Republican Party now, what most concerns me is the extent to which it appears to be abandoning any semblance of maturity and is largely being defined by people who, to me, sound every bit as shrill and dogmatic and intemperate as the vegan Marxists who I used to pal around with in college. Do you at all share my concern?
I'm concerned with the political rhetoric with both parties, actually.
Okay, we're talking about the Republican Party now, but
if you're asking me whether there was the tone, there was more than tone. There was actually language that was used. It wasn't the tone by Trump in exciting his base that I found offensive and politically self-defeating.
But doesn't this go way beyond Trump? I mean, during the primaries, we heard Ted Cruz saying that the Obama administration was the world's leading financier of Islamic terrorism. Then we heard Mike Huckabee invoking Holocaust imagery to rail against a nuclear deal with Iran. And then Ben Carson said that Obamacare is the worst thing that has happened to this country since slavery. I mean, isn't all of that just rhetorical diarrhea?
It was over the top. We think that politics, as we were saying, Marty, as we were chatting before we went on, we think this is unusual or something new in American politics.
Yeah.
It's not. American politics has always been rough. It's in terms of opponents and in terms of language and in terms of rhetoric.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's new. If you're asking me if I condone that kind of language and some of the statements that were being said, no, I don't.
You know, it seems to me that any political party that aspires to win a national election has to bring people together who have no business being together, which is sort of what it's like at my house on Thanksgiving. But, you know, with respect to Republicans, I mean, you have libertarians who celebrate risk and creative destruction, aligned with social conservatives that are strongly inclined to put traditional values ahead of personal freedom. You have wealthy corporate interests aligned with struggling workers who perhaps now more than ever believe that what we call the free market is entirely rigged against them. So these are not natural bedfellows. And I guess I'm wondering, now that Trump is the nominee, are these odd, unnatural alliances at a breaking point?
I think when you get, I think political parties are made up of coalitions. The Democrats have, I think, actually an uneasier coalition.
A more uneasy coalition than the Republicans?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And what's their coalition? Corporate, Wall Street, and poor people.
Let me ask you this. As part of a pro-family, pro-life platform, how difficult would it be for a Republican presidential candidate to unambiguously come out in favor of requiring businesses to provide paid parental leave to their workers?
For the next president?
I
think it...
How difficult would it be for Trump or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or any of them?
The question is how difficult...
How
would it play?
Yeah, they didn't. And right. so that suggests to me that even though polls say there's overwhelming support for that idea, no Republican this year came out in favor of it.
Yeah, I don't think that's...
Why, or at least not unambiguously in favor of it. There was some hedging there among a few of the candidates. But why is that so difficult for Republicans?
Because there's kind of a simple idea behind this. I know it's sometimes hard to explain. Businesses make, in order to make for better business, it's best to allow them to make their decisions. If they need to recruit employees, such as Apple, that's one of the things that they can entice workers with paid leave, which they've done. Mm-hmm. Let business decide, not the federal government.
And I understand that ideology, but the
it's not ideology, it's a common sense.
Well, but why is, when you look at the rest of the world, just about every other country in the world does this. And I'm not just talking about rich countries. I'm talking about countries like Algeria. So are Republicans saying that we as Americans should be proud of this distinction that we have of being the only country in the world that doesn't do that?
No, it's not a matter of pride. It's a matter of maintaining productivity. And actually, there's arguments for the kinds of benefits that European countries and other countries have provided, including Japan, how it's led to serious declines in productivity, as well as kind of stagnant economies. I mean, it's because of this, because of these kinds of self-righteous sentiment that, around issues of social justice that you're suggesting, there's led to economic stagnation in Japan and now Europe.
So the America,
in the end, that does not benefit.
Yeah, so the United States being alone on this.
But it's not a matter of pride or rhetoric.
But we're alone. We're basically alone. I mean, if you look down the list.
We're alone on a lot of things.
And this is something to be proud of. This is a good thing for the United States.
A matter of pride. Yes, it should be a matter of pride.
Is it a good thing?
Is it a good thing for what?
For this country to not require businesses to provide paid parental leave.
And it's a good thing. We should
and this
take
is
pride.
The Republican Party is a pro-family party.
Marty, it's a good thing to let business decide these kinds of issues.
Okay.
And we should take pride in that.
Okay. So explain to me what's going on with Christian evangelicals. These are the people who insist that they want their presidents to behave like good Christians.
Huh.
Yet during the primaries, millions of these voters voted for Donald Trump, who once said on the Howard Stern show that as a young man, his personal Vietnam was avoiding venereal disease. What do you make of how evangelicals are responding to Trump?
So the appeal of Trump, and you've heard it, I'm not the first to say it, well, he was using politically, incorrect language. A lot of people are tired of these evangelical Christians of not being able to go out in a time of joy and say Merry Christmas at a store. That's the kind of thing they're tired of being called racist. They're tired of being called bigots. Because evangelical Christians, many of them, go to large churches where they have very mixed ethnic populations. Blacks, Hispanics, they're out there doing work in their communities, unlike those living in San Francisco talking about what wine is best and whether the Argentinian wine is better than the new New Zealand wine and what the latest food should be eaten. They're out there working in drug rehabilitation, after school programs, working with single parents, and so forth. And they got tired of it. And so, that's what they were. That's what Trump tapped into.
So, do you think Trump's nomination signals the waning influence of religion on voting behavior?
Religion is declining. Religious affiliation, organized religion, it's remained somewhat steady for evangelicals, but not growing. Steady for Catholics as well. But the great spurt that they enjoy has now steadied. We've become a secular country. In terms of voting, evangelicals are a very sizable portion of the Republican Party in every state, surprisingly, even states like Wisconsin. You have 40% or more of the, I guess 35% of Republican voters will declare themselves evangelical. So it's a force within the Republican Party. It's going to remain.
Okay, so let's suppose for a moment that come November, Donald Trump loses by a landslide. Let's just suppose that. And let's suppose as well that he takes down with him the Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. Let's suppose that happens. Mm-hmm. Which wing of the Republican Party do you think is in a best position to pick up the pieces? Is it the hardcore conservative Ted Cruz wing? Is it the more wonkish Paul Ryan wing? Is it the libertarian Rand Paul wing? Or will we perhaps be looking at a Humpty Dumpty scenario here where no one will quite be able to put the pieces back together? Mm-hmm. And if that happens, mm-hmm. will Republicans go the way of the Whigs?
Yeah, I don't think we're talking about a Whig party, but I think we're going to see, you know, probably great changes no matter what happens in this election, just because of this new period we're entering as a country and a world, and with the technological changes and globalization and so forth. So I think we're entering probably into a new world of politics, which is very hard to predict at this point. I think we're in for a very, very volatile politics for both parties in the next next decade.
Care to make a prediction who the next nominee will be for the Republican Party if Trump loses?
I don't think it's going to be Ted Cruz.
Okay, have any idea who it will be?
I think there could be someone emerging from that didn't run this time.
Someone that we haven't heard about yet.
Right. A new face.
Professor, I want to thank you so much for doing this program.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.